The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. The House narrowly passed a five-year farm bill yesterday afternoon, and I mean really narrow, 213 to 211 votes, which means that 23 Republicans crossed the aisle to vote against it. What is in this bill? Helping us make sense of this is Christopher Basso. He is a professor of public policy at Northeastern University. His areas of interest include food and environmental policy, science and technology policy, and the governance of emerging technologies. He's the author of Framing the Farm Bill: Interests, Ideology, and the Agricultural Act of 2014. Christopher Basso, welcome to the program.
Good. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
We are also taking calls this hour, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Morning. I'm specifically interested in farmers. What do you think of this farm bill that the House has passed? What are the provisions you like? What are the provisions you don't like? Are you sure you understand the bill? And do you think really it's going to get through the Senate? What do you think you're going to end up with? 800-642-1234. So, Chris, last month the farm bill failed spectacularly when conservatives withheld their support because they pegged it to an immigration measure. What changed this time that the farm bill finally passed?
Well, I think the fact that they got a chance to discuss immigration helped a bit in making sure people were in the chamber. I think what really mattered was that many of the conservatives decided to go ahead and support the bill at this stage, perhaps as a favor to Speaker Ryan, to get it out of the House, to get it to the Senate. They still may be opposed to it in the end, depending on what the final elements are in the conference committee version. But I think that there was enough members of the Freedom Caucus who changed their vote, roughly 20 members changed their vote, to get it through the House as a favor to the leadership primarily.
So talk to me about the 23 Republicans who voted against it.
Well, most but not all tend to be, again, the Freedom Caucus members that tend to be the most conservative members of the House Republican body, the House majority. They tend to be opposed to the farm bill both this time and also last time, 2013-14, because of the perception of it's a massive spending bill, roughly $860 billion over 10 years, although it never really goes that far. A lot of that, of course, is SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which is about 80% of farm bill spending. They want to trim back that program. They also want to trim back commodity programs. It's not, so the Freedom Caucus...
Programs, you mean programs that actually help farmers with subsidies.
Right. I mean, for a lot of the Freedom Caucus members, and certainly not all, but a lot of them, commodity programs are essentially welfare for rich farmers. That's the perception, fair or not. I mean, and so the fact that you have a perception that a lot of the commodity programs are propping up large agricultural operations, not small mom and pop farmers. Again, it's perceptions, and there's a lot of data on this. It feeds that sort of feeling that the spending on the farm bill, it needs to be reined in. That's the perception among the Freedom Caucus.
Is that perception accurate in terms of going to rich farmers and not necessarily farms that are struggling along?
Well, certainly the perception. I mean, there's a lot of data that obviously, as critics on all sides, both left and right, on commodity programs, the spending on commodity programs. The big ones, corn, wheat, soy, those ones tend to go disproportionately to larger operations. Again, they could be family-owned operations, whatever the definition is these days, mm-hmm. but they tend to be large operations. And so people like Chuck Grassley in Iowa in the Senate have been really active in trying to limit, commodity supports. Either by the amount you can get per year or to the certain size of the operation or notions of who's actively engaged in farming because of data on, people who are essentially landowners getting the subsidies, not the actual themselves. Those who are listening who are farmers understand that they are caught in a bit of a bind here because of perception and a fair bit of data supporting the notion that a lot of subsidies, either direct subsidies or insurance-based subsidies, are going to larger producers, not the small mom-and-pop operations that we tend to think about.
So why not just craft the farm bill so it goes to the right people?
Sorry, say that again.
Why not just craft the farm bill so it goes to those smaller mom-and-pop operations?
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly that would be what Chuck Grassley wants to do. But, you know, you have tremendous resistance to that in the farm sector. Because a lot of, you know, obviously as farming has consolidated over the last 40, 50 years, I mean, you know, a fair bit of large commodity production is, you know, larger producers. I mean, you know, and so they will, of course, fight any kind of effort to trim back commodity supports based on income, annual revenues or income or size, you know, because they would argue that that's not fair to them. They take risks just like everybody else does.
We are talking about the bill that was passed in the House yesterday, extended the farm bill for 5 years. The bill now needs to be taken up in the Senate, and the Senate version is probably going to be looking a little different. We're taking your calls, 800-642-1234. Are you a small farmer? Are you a large farmer? What do you think of this bill and the subsidies that are going to be going away or at least getting less in it? Ideas@WPR.org is the email if you would like. 800-642-1234 is the phone number. So, Chris, the work requirements part of the bill, some people get government assistance. How do food stamps fit into a farm bill?
Well, that's a long, long story. SNAP, I mean, obviously the current name, SNAP, Supplement Nutrition Assistance Program, which goes back, I mean, the origins of those, I mean, everybody needs to understand that the origins of what we now call SNAP, but it used to be called food stamps, go back to a 1930s era New Deal effort to use up farm surpluses. I mean, so, yeah, and so, you know, this conception, of, you know, that what people don't really realize is that SNAP is a, you know, roughly $70 billion a year, depending on the actual spending, which is entirely based on economic conditions. SNAP is essentially a subsidy to the farm, to the food system. I mean, it's indirect subsidy to agriculture. It's an indirect subsidy to the food producers and retailers, and it's a direct subsidy to those who actually eat food. But it's, you know, it's hugely controversial, obviously. But people need to understand the reason why it is the way it is that it also is, in fact, and historically has been, a way to use up surpluses. It was tied to commodity purchasing originally in the 60s, 1964 Food Stamp Act. It was tied very directly in some respects to certain kinds of commodities, cheese, milk, potatoes, that kind of stuff. But now, of course, you can use it to buy whatever food you want, because food is, as far as the food system people are concerned, food is food, and they don't want to discriminate. So SNAP is designed the way it is, primarily, and it's in the USDA, because its primary mission, in many respects, has always been to help deal with surpluses.
And we have surpluses now, correct?
I'm sorry?
Do we have surpluses now? Are there certain sectors?
We have always have surpluses. The problem we have, you know, American farmers are tremendously efficient. I mean, and the problem is if everybody's very efficient, and there's only so much food even Americans can eat, and if we don't export enough of it, then we end up with surpluses. You know, we still have 20 million pounds of cheese lying around in warehouses. I mean, you know, and so, you know, the government still buys surplus foods. Now, most of the time, we don't do that anymore. I mean, back in as early as the early 60s, the federal government purchasing and storing surpluses was like the third largest item in the federal budget at one time. So that's why the SNAP program and others like it, export-driven export programs, are designed to deal with surpluses, because we invariably have surpluses. Farmers in Wisconsin know full well that you just have lakes of milk because you produce too much. And I know it's a controversial issue, these sort of dairy management notions, but the inevitable result of very efficient farming with no, you know, controls is surplus.
And the farm bill, this is a question that I've been wanting to ask for a long time. If the farm bill goes, I'm not in the farm bill, but if SNAP goes away because people aren't making the work requirements, is that going to hurt farmers directly because they can't do anything with their surplus? The government will buy their surplus.
It's more indirect. I mean, essentially what you're doing is you're reducing, in one level, you're reducing consumption.
Mm-hmm.
And so any reduction in consumption or the ability to buy certain kinds of food you know, obviously has a ripple effects on producers. Now, some argue that, okay, even if SNAP went away, we'd still have all a surplus to, you know, that we have to deal with, and then we would sort of go back to the old-fashioned, you know, charity model of essentially giving surplus foods to poor people, which, you know, that sort of food bank, you know, food pantry model, which is that's the old model. I mean, the old model was literally you went to the food pantry and you got your surplus federal commodities. And that still happens to some extent. Mm-hmm. But SNAP was designed, food stamps are designed to essentially enable poor people or those who need supplemental assistance to purchase their food directly in stores, not to have to go to a food pantry.
We are going to explore that in a moment. We're talking about the Farm Bill that was passed by the House yesterday, and we're taking your calls, 800-642-1234. We're going to get to some of those calls in a moment. It's the morning show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We are talking about the Farm Bill that the House passed yesterday with Chris Basso from Northeastern University. Chris, we ended our conversation just a moment ago talking about food stamps. I do want to get back to that, but we do have a caller who is a small-scale farmer here, actually in Illinois. Jim, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. How are you today?
I'm good. So what do you think about this?
Well, as I said to the person that took my call when I called in, I'm kind of unfamiliar with the stipulations that the Farm Bill has, particularly in my context. As you mentioned, I'm a very small-scale, intensive organic farmer. We focus on food production. We're not doing fuel or fodder corn. We're not doing wheat or soy, any of that stuff. So from what I understand, without actually knowing a whole lot about the history of the Farm Bill or how it's been changed, I don't think this stuff really taps into our industry a whole lot because we're what you all consider the mom-and-pop operation.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have less than 20 acres in production, but in my humble opinion, I think we're doing some of the most important farming there is because we're providing food that's healthy for people and in a fashion that's actually regenerating and restoring our soil, which has been a big, big problem with these large commodity crops and the big ag industry for several decades now. So I'm kind of curious how this does, if it does, tap into our relevance in the industry.
Okay.
And also I just kind of want to make a comment on how I think the Farm Bill, hopefully it is being shifted towards this, but it should be more supportive of allowing people who do have SNAP benefits to actually use these funds at farmers markets, because I know that that is an option in some markets, but it seems to be very hit or miss as far as where you can and cannot use your SNAP benefits.
Those are both great questions. So let's take the first one first, Chris. He's got a farm that's less than 20 acres. Does this Farm Bill affect him at all?
Oh, yes, it does. In fact, what's interesting here is that if you'd asked me this question, you know, 10, 15 years ago, I might have said not really. But now it does, because since 2008, you know, because of efforts by, you know, especially because in the Senate, you know, you've got provisions in there for organic, provisions for what they call specialty crops. I mean, more research, more supports for, again, farmers markets and utilization of SNAP benefits at farmers markets. Again, some of that is depending what state you're in terms of how much it's done, but there's money out there for that the USDA has in the Farm Bill because of efforts by representatives from more urban and suburban constituencies and in the Senate who are really pushing the Farm Bill to have more stuff that is of concern directly to, you know, consumers.
Mm.
And people are interested in these kind of things. You know, small farms like gentlemen's here, you know, 10, 20 acres are the only area of where there's more of those now than there were 10 years ago in the country. You know, so clearly responding to consumers' desires for more local, more organic, more sustainable, more family farm-raised kinds of food. And the Farm Bill has reflected that. The last couple have reflected those trends because members from non-agricultural districts and states, or, you know, especially in the Senate, have been pushing the Farm Bill to include those provisions precisely to ensure that, first of all, that members of Congress from non-ag areas care about the Farm Bill, and also because they make it more relevant to consumers. So, for example, the utilization of SNAP benefits at farmers' markets. Well, here in the Boston area where I live, that's a big thing, because the state government here and the local governments and nonprofits have really made an effort to utilize, to help expand the utilization of SNAP benefits at farmers' markets in all over the place, to ensure that lower-income residents have higher access to healthy, affordable food. So those things do matter, because if the Farm Bill does not get renewed, for example, by the deadline, and there's no continuing resolution in terms of funding, those provisions go away.
Hmm.
A lot of the provisions that people care about now, like organic, like farmers markets, et cetera, those things are not part of what's called the permanent law, and they expire when the Farm Bill expires.
So if they don't pass anything, this stuff will go away. But this,
right.
But this is in the House's Farm Bill and likely will be in the Senate's Farm Bill. So if they do pass something, some compromise bill, it will still be in here.
That's correct. Well, it depends, because it depends on what's in the final Farm Bill. But, yeah, for the most part, I can't see a Farm Bill passing at all without continuing those programs. Those programs are, for example, Debbie Stabenow, Senator from Michigan, who is the highest-ranking Democrat in the Senate Agriculture Committee. She cares a lot about organics. She cares a lot about these kinds of programs, as do members of Congress, many from both parties, not just one party, but especially Democrats who are more urban and suburban. And in the Senate, you see more support for these kinds of things, country of origin labeling, for example, all these kinds of things that people care about. The Farm Bill contains those things, which is the reason why people should pay attention to it, even if they're not farmers.
Okay. So thank you, Jim, for that. That was really a thoughtful question, actually a couple of questions. I want to go back, Chris, to talking about SNAP benefits. Does the hospital want to eliminate them altogether?
No, I mean, obviously there might be some members who would like to do that, but they tend to be the fringe. What the House bill does is it would, in fact, increase work requirements for people who are able-bodied adults. It would increase their work requirements, mandate that they have to work at least 20 hours a week or get training or be in training programs if they aren't already. And obviously it would affect by some estimate 7 million SNAP recipients.
How many actual SNAP recipients are there?
About 42 million right now. Now most of those are children. I mean, about 42 million SNAP recipients. But of them, roughly 44% of SNAP recipients are children.
Mm.
And 63% roughly of the adults we're talking about are women. So the modal SNAP recipient typically is a woman with kids. And so that's where we get into some difficulties here, because the critics argue that these work requirements would not be very useful for a lot of these people, because a lot of these people already work. I mean, anywhere from 35 to 40% of SNAP recipients work already.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the criticism is that these kinds of requirements would not work very well because, again, given who the target population is, there's some question about the capacity of state governments to actually carry these things out. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Are there enough jobs out there? Are there enough training programs? What cost would they have? Would the cost of the programs actually exceed the cost of the SNAP benefits? I mean, there's a lot of really interesting questions here. And a lot of SNAP users are already exempt because, again, of disability or they're senior citizens. So it's targeting a specific subgroup that is already probably, in many respects, working or has the young women with kids. So there's a real debate. And critics of the House bill argue that it's simply going to be a way of tossing people off of SNAP because they won't be able to fulfill those new work rules.
I find it interesting. Will it also burden the people who are exempt from these work rules, the people who are disabled, people who already have a job, because they will have to fill out more paperwork to prove that they're working or that they're disabled?
More likely. I have my students to sort of go through the SNAP application process just to see what it's like.
Mm.
And, we tend, again, I'm there's certainly an argument on both sides here, but applying for SNAP benefits is not easy. And depending what state you're in, states have the ability to make it easier or harder. And there's certain baseline things you need to do. But, you know, states who implement this. So states make it easier or harder to apply. And you have to fill out all kinds of forms. You have to show eligibility. You have to prove your income. You have to show assets. And you have to renew, in some cases, every 6 months, depending what state you're in. You know, and the average benefit is roughly $125 per person per month. So we're not talking about a huge amount of money per person, in that sense. But so we do create a fair number of hurdles out there, you know, for a lot of good reasons. We don't want to make sure that people who aren't eligible get benefits. And the USDA estimates that, you know, the fraud rate is relatively low. I mean, 2 or 3%, depending on who you ask. But, you know, we do make it pretty difficult for people to apply.
I'm curious. You say you take your students through the application process. Do you actually take them to the food stamp office?
No.
Okay.
I mean, a lot of states now have online application processes.
Okay.
So, I mean, now, of course, you know, finding those depends what state, again, you're in. Some states don't do that. Most states increasingly do. And you have income verifications. You have, you know, I mean, again, number of people in the household and income verification,
right.
Assets. I mean, you know, I mean, what are your assets? I mean, if you have too many assets, you're not eligible. Now, you're allowed to have a car because you have to go to work, you know, and you're allowed to keep your home. But, you know, there's a certain degree to which it's an asset test. It's a good way to think about SNAP also as an anti-poverty program. I mean, so a lot of this is really based on income.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as your income goes up, your benefits go down.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it works. And so when the economy gets better and people go back to work, SNAP spending goes down, which it has done in the last 5 years.
We are talking about the farm bill that the House passed yesterday. It's going to be going to the Senate. The Senate will vote on its own bill, and they will have to reconcile the two bills, which are likely going to be pretty different. We are taking your calls, 800-642-1234. And you can also email us at WPRideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Christopher Basso, let's turn to the politics of this. Paul Ryan needed this to happen, and the Republican Party showed itself to be fractured both in May and now. Can we see, what does this tell us about the Republican Party?
Well, the Republican Party has become, I mean, the Republican Party has, it's a conservative party, but you've got splits in the Republican Party. Again, the Freedom Caucus group, which, you know, 40 to 50 members, which are the most conservative members, you know, tend to be hardliners on spending. I mean, obviously, it depends on sometimes on what things you're talking about.
Right, they just passed a big tax bill, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, and they tend to be hardliners on other things like immigration. And it's important that people understand that a lot of times what's going on here is that, you know, the farm bill oftentimes is being held hostage to other issues, whether it's immigration or deficit reduction or some other, you know, priority of especially the most conservative members who, you know, again, tend to have the leverage in the House with the leadership. And the irony for Paul Ryan is that he can't pass a farm bill without, you know, assuming, you know, the House could pass a farm bill entirely in Republican votes because the Democrats said your changes in SNAP basically are unacceptable to us as a party. And there's very few rural Democrats left act as bridges.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to rely on the Republican Party, which is itself really divided right now on a lot of issues. And he doesn't have, I mean, so the irony for Paul Ryan is he has a majority, but as his predecessor John Boehner discovered, a majority doesn't always guarantee success. When you have divisions within your own party, and when the divisions are ideological, you know that Paul Ryan cannot promise, some kind of benefit to these members to get them to vote. Basically, you know, the old days where you could say, well, if you go along, well, I'll make sure you get a new program for your district.
Right, we'll get a bridge. We'll get a bridge to nowhere for you.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, it doesn't work. I mean, and it's not that much money anyway, but and these folks are more, if you're ideological, then you're not going to be easily, you know, swayed. And
so,
they did this essentially, you know, as a favor, just in this case, But there's no guarantee these folks will vote for the final version if the final version is closer to the Senate version than the House version. I think passage in the House is not guaranteed.
Interesting. So so how does it work if the Senate comes back with a version that doesn't have this food stamp work requirement provision, then the House members have to vote on it again?
Well, what's going to happen is that the likely scenario is that you have two different versions, one passed by each chamber. It's going to go into a conference committee, and the conference committee is a super committee that is, members of the House and the members of the Senate sit on, they're appointed by the respective leadership, and they'll work out a compromise sort of conference report version, which then goes back to each chamber where you can vote up or down on it. There's no amendments. And, if the tendency is, what we've seen in the past is that the tendency is for the conference report to reflect more the Senate's broader view of things than the House's. I mean, the House bill tends to reflect its majority's interest. And the majority in the House right now is a very conservative Republican majority from very homogenous constituencies. And I have to say that the one thing that the House is now reflecting is the very homogenous constituencies of the majority party. Whereas the Senate, Senate Republicans represent much broader constituencies than their House counterparts, which is why the Senate version is going to be different. It's not going to have the same stringency in it on SNAP requirements. If the conference version reflects more the Senate's view, and I suspect it will, because, for example, Colin Peterson from Minnesota, the ranking Democrat in the House Ag Committee, he's going to go along with the Senate version, not the House version. He's been very clear about that. Because his party, he needs to get his party on board. And so if it's too much close to the Senate version, there's a lot of House Republicans who may not go along with it unless, and this is the wild card, unless the president, tries to get them to support it.
And if they don't go along with it, the bill fails.
The bill fails. And, then obviously, what happens then, Congress can easily pass, continuing resolution to keep funding going into the next year, which has happened in the past, and go back to the drawing board. If this happens before the elections or even after the elections, and then let's say, for example, the Democrats take back the House in the elections, which is possible, not probable, then it's a whole new dynamic. And so then you get into the sort of, as you get close to the election, the question is, are people going to say, hey, we're going to hold out for the election and see what happens? So it's very possible. It's possible they can get it done before the end of September. I'm not a betting man. I'd say it's probably less likely it's going to happen. But again, commodity prices are a problem right now in the Farm Belt. You got trade issues that are concerning farmers. So I think there's a lot more desire in the farm bloc to get this done and not play games with it. But they don't necessarily have control anymore.
The Farm Bill is an omnibus bill. It's an umbrella bill. More than $430 billion worth of food and agriculture programs. When we come back, we are going to talk about who's affected most by the Farm Bill and where the subsidies are coming from. And the states, we're going to pick up a little bit about what you talked about, the state's responsibility for many of these subsidies and these training programs. We are talking about the Farm Bill. It's The Morning Show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. It's The Morning Show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. What do you think of the House Farm Bill that passed yesterday? Are you a farmer? And does this bill excite you or depress you? 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. We are talking to Christopher Basso from Northeastern University in Massachusetts. Christopher, I want to, you mentioned states. States are going to have to pay for these the work requirements for food stamps recipients. They're going to have to pay for training and what have you. A lot of this rests on the states, and are the states able to handle it?
Well, that's the good question, and critics argue their answer is no. I mean, now the House Farm Bill provision it would enable the states to tap some funds in the SNAP program for these kinds of programs. But the real question is state capacity. Do the states have the infrastructure to do these kinds of things? I mean, you know, they would get some funds through the SNAP program for these kinds of efforts, and critics argue that would take money away from actually food for people, as opposed to giving money to the states for administration. But there's been some test programs, other than this in Washington State, for example, relatively new. There's no good data on this yet, but there's real questions are being raised about the ability of state governments and their administrative side to actually design these programs, to administer them, to assess their impacts. You know, all these kinds of nitty-gritty details of essentially, job programs that we always have difficulties with. So there's real skepticism among critics of this provision.
We are talking about the Farm Bill that was passed yesterday in the House, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@WPR.org. We have one question here. How many of those receiving food stamps are elderly or disabled and unable to work? And the bill does not affect them. The work requirements don't affect them. It's just able-bodied adults, correct?
Yes. I mean, obviously, able-bodied adults, sort of so-called able-bodied adults, it's a difficult one because there's a lot of different data here. But, the elderly, for example, probably make up around, 20%. If you take elderly, disabled, all that group, that makes up a good chunk of SNAP recipients. It's hard for me to. I have to look at the data, latest data, but the image we have in our heads is of food stamp recipients, SNAP recipients. Doesn't align always with the reality. And again, the largest chunk tends to go to kids. Now, the kids may have parents, obviously,
right,
who can work. But remember, it's income based, so it's a family unit. So even if you have two adults in a family unit who are both working, if their income levels are below the threshold, they're eligible for supplemental assistance.
And I'm interested in which states have more food stamp recipients. Do you know that?
Off the top of my head, no. I mean, obviously, the highest utilization rates tend to be the most poor. It's poverty-based. So the poorer states tend to have the highest utilization rates. Obviously, you'll have pockets of high utilization in urban areas in some states, but a lot of the highest utilization rates are in rural states, in the South.
Mm-hmm.
Or places like Tennessee, Kentucky, obviously the Deep South. And, of course, then you'll have high utilization rates, comparatively speaking, in some urban areas. 15 to 20%, somehow is 25% utilization rates, in terms of per capita utilization. But, again, it varies. And, it varies all over the country. But, again, it's directly correlated with income and poverty. So where poverty rates are high, SNAP utilization rates are high. It's a pretty simple equation.
Talk to me about the bill's history. Has it always been this contentious?
Well, it's always contention, but it's never been this ideological. I think what we've seen over time, it used to be the case back, 50 years ago, that all you had to do is sit in a room and say, all right, what do you want for corn? What do you want for soybeans? What do you want for beef? What do you want for cotton? What do you want for sugar? And everybody gets their little piece of the pie in terms of commodity program support. You staple it together, you call it a farm bill. But as the percentage of Americans who actually farm has plummeted to, 1.7% of Americans actually farm today, and as farming districts get emptier and emptier of people, you have a lot of farms but no people farming them. You don't need too many people farming farms anymore, especially commodity crops, row crops. So the leverage of the farm block has plummeted in some respects. So you need those other voices in the room, those other programs, whether it's nutrition programs or organics or trade or, animal welfare kinds of issues. All those have to be brought in the room more and more to get the votes of people who don't live in farm districts or who don't farm. And the more you bring in all these different voices, immigration, trade, the more it gets very contentious and ideological. So the last couple of farm bills have been tremendously ideological. SNAP is the biggest pivot point, obviously, but not only SNAP. I mean, trade issues come up, immigration issues come up, and these tend to be ideological. And they tend to pit conservatives against liberals, Democrats, Republicans, and in ways that the old farm bills did not. Because, if you go back 50 years ago, there were enough conservative rural Democrats out there to be a bridge. And you tend to fight the battles based on which crop you grew. Mm. Now the battles are more ideological. When they get ideological, they get harder to resolve.
We're talking about the farm bill that the House passed yesterday. It's going to be taken up in the Senate soon. We are taking your calls, 800-642-1234. Kathleen from La Crosse, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for the program and all the programs you have. My comments go back to discussing food share or SNAP. And if your guest is able to comment on, I have three areas, and then I'll take my comments off the air. The first thing is, for consumers, I think it would be good for people to know they don't have to apply online. They have the right to request a face-to-face appointment, and that's something that's very important for some people to get that human touch that is so rare in our society. And then two other different direction comments. If you could comment on where the money for food share comes from. It's my understanding that means we're bringing back federal money to our state, money that we've paid in. And then the third, and I think that's important for average citizens to know. And then my third comment is, it's also my understanding that when food share benefits come into a local economy, it has a significantly positive effect on that economy. So if you're able to comment on those things, I think that would be helpful for people.
Those are great questions, Kathleen. You can write questions for me anytime. Thank you very much. Chris, want to take those up?
Sure. I mean, the first one, obviously, again, as I point out, states implement SNAP based on federal guidelines. But states have some leeway in how easier or harder they make it on people to actually apply. So some states are very good in terms of state SNAP outreach, making sure they have people who are helping people sign up who are eligible. Others make it more difficult. So it's just a matter of what state you're living in to how easy or how difficult it is to actually apply. I mean, how much outreach is there to those? I mean, you're not allowed to advertise SNAP, but you can do outreach. You can have people at health clinics. You can have people, at farmers markets in other places where potentially eligible people might go. But again, that does vary by state. So you could be in a state where the state does very little additional outreach efforts on purpose. Kathleen's right, in the sense that one big issue on SNAP is it's dollars. These are essentially federal anti-poverty dollars. Again, they're tied to purchasing food. They're not just dollars you can use for anything, and you have an EBT card, which is very restrictive in what you can use it for. These are dollars coming to communities, and those who are concerned about cutbacks say, these are dollars coming to communities that have economic development basis. The USDA averages that there's sort of a multiplier effect from every SNAP dollar spent. There's other dollars being spent, and that money goes into the communities. It goes into stores. It goes into people's pockets. So, Kathleen's right in a sense that, SNAP dollars are like any federal money. This is money that goes into the economy, which is why a lot of governors, especially in more not I want to use the hackneyed blue versus red, but a lot of governors really are concerned that, you know, it's cutbacks and SNAP that are that go beyond the normal sort of, you know, income poverty adjustment issues, that's real money coming into their states, and they're not going to be inclined to sort of look past that money if it's there. That's free money for states. Well, it's, you know, free in the sense that, you know, obviously it comes out of the tax, you know, we pay and everything, but it's money that comes back in the communities, and that's the that's the way people think about it.
And food share helps. So it does come back from federal, but it comes to people's EBT cards, and then they spend it, and that's how it helps the economy.
Right.
Somebody did call in with a question about, is there a trend of cutting social support? Does food stamps portend that we're going to get Medicare cut, Medicaid cut? Is that kind of all the...
Concern people have. The current administration and especially, you know, House Republican majority is keen to cut back on the social welfare system. I mean, that's what they're keen. They've made no bones about what they want to do. Obviously Medicare and Social Security still are, you know, highly contentious areas. People have paid into them. But, you know, so obviously, you know, they'll probably go after Medicaid more likely and SNAP first because these are to some more low-income populations. But it's quite clear that, you know, conservatives and liberals have a very different set of views about the social welfare safety net, the notion of who deserves and on what basis. And the current administration and the current Congress, I would think it's safe to say, are more on the cut back the social safety net to essentially and let states do more of it as opposed to the federal government. It's going to be a very contentious time in that respect.
I want to throw this out for next time, because I would like you to come back next time, because one of the things you talked about is that poorer states have more food stamps. Poorer states also tend to have more conservative representatives, and that's going to hurt the people that they represent. We have no time to talk about that now, but I would like to maybe build a show around that in the future. Thank you, Chris Basso, for being on the program with us today.
It was my pleasure. I enjoyed it.
Chris is a professor of public policy at Northeastern University, and he's the author of Framing the Farm Bill, Interests, Ideology, and the Agricultural Act of 2014. We've been talking about the Farm Bill. Thank you for your calls. It's the Morning Show.